A squid eating dough in a polyethylene bag is fast and bulbous, got me? And a $5 prize to the first person who points out what that reference is. Chris is looking puzzled.
Yeah. I'm Christopher Carter, he's David Robertson, and we are in the Castle Arms, right beside the hub, just down from Edinburgh Castle, on this sort of fairly nondescript January day.
And we are the Religious Studies Project, and we're glad to be welcoming you to the third podcast already of this third year of the Religious Studies Project, which is by Tom Flynn. On the subject of secular humanism. Who's Tom Flynn?
Well, I'm going to get this wrong if I try and tell you. What I can tell you is that he is the sort of editor of Free Inquiry magazine, and he's very big in the American secularist movement. He's also the editor of the New Encyclopedia of Unbelief, which is an academic collection. I know it features like Frank Pasquale and a few other sort of big scholars of the non-religious. It's on secular humanism. So as you'll hear in the interview, it's not the same as atheism. It's not the same as non-religion. And you know, we figure, if we do podcasts on Santo Daime or sort of other sort of interesting particular types of religion, well, here's a phenomenon, a social phenomenon, which is involved in the societal discourse on religion by defining itself as non-religious, and it's a good interview.
I'm going to put you on the spot about that afterwards, but for now, let's cut to the interview. Tommy, take it away.
This is Thomas Coleman. I'm here at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York, with the Executive Director for the Council for Secular Humanism, Tom Flynn. I went to your website earlier today, the Council for Secular Humanism, and in bold print above the website for the council, it says, beyond atheism, beyond agnosticism, secular humanism. What is secular humanism, and why or how is it beyond atheism and agnosticism?
Secular humanism is, or at least it tries to be, a complete and balanced life stance. It's based in a realistic appraisal of this world, which means that it does not accept belief in a supernatural realm for which there appears to be no compelling proof. It sees human beings as being essentially on their own in the world, but also as capable of learning the lessons from the world around them, seeing what works and what doesn't for a social species and a world of this type, and arriving at objectively demonstrable values. What's the best way for human beings who are sharing this world to live? It's not simply a matter of taste. It's not something handed down from on high. It's something that we have to work out for ourselves, and since we have to, it's very fortunate that we probably can. And so in that sense, in the idea of human beings coming together and not creating a value system out of nothing, but building values that respond to the realities of life, that's the sense in which we mean that secular humanism goes beyond atheism or beyond agnosticism. Just atheism is basically the disbelief in a god or gods and the supernatural. That's very important. We think that's an essential step towards maturing as a human being, recognizing that we don't have a supernatural being looking out for our welfare. But it's limited in a sense. You know, once you arrive at atheism, you can be atheist, mm-hmm. and decide to be a recluse. You can be an atheist and decide to exploit your fellow humans. You know, all kinds of moral stances are possible for atheism alone. Now, that's not to say, a lot of religious people like to say that atheists are depraved because they don't, have the guidance of God. Not at all. Atheists are capable of, sublime moral insight. In fact, a lot of a lot of my favorite atheists are really secular humanists, and they're fine people, and they've got great values. But it's just atheism or agnosticism. They're great, but they're only positions on the existence of the supernatural. And it takes more than that to build a complete life stance.
In terms of life stances, perhaps one could consider religion as such. Understanding that, is secular humanism a religion? Why or why not?
Well, a lot depends on what you mean by religion.
Certainly.
And there are thinkers in the liberal religious tradition, Paul Tillich is probably one of the best known, who basically define religion extremely broadly and say that religion is whatever might be the object of your ultimate concern, whatever means the most to you is your religion. Now, we're sitting here in a suburb of Buffalo, New York, and if Paul Tillich is correct, far too many people here practice the religion of the Buffalo Bills.
Certainly.
I don't think that's a terribly useful definition of religion. So I tend to prefer, and I mean, you know, Council for Secular Humanism tends to prefer, a definition of religion that requires some supernatural component. You know, religions are ways of looking at the world, life stances, if you will. Religions certainly are life stances. But religions are a specific type of life stance in that they assert the existence of a supernatural order, and they assert that the existence of that supernatural order is profoundly important to human beings. Show me a life stance that doesn't have those two features, and I'll show you something that in a meaningful sense is not a religion. Now, if we define religion that way, and I think there are a lot of good arguments for doing that, for one, it respects the boundaries between, you know, closely associated terms like philosophy and ethics. So you know, if we say that religion necessarily includes a supernatural component, well then, secular humanism, since it rejects the supernatural, clearly is not a religion. And we attach a good deal of importance to that, in part because there are humanists out there in the community who view their humanism as a religious commitment, describe themselves as religious humanists, and our adversaries on the religious right absolutely love that those people are out there. Mm-hmm. And they love to point to them and say, look, humanism is a religion. Let's keep it out of schools. Now, in a sense, I'm very happy when I hear them say that, because that's the only time that most people on the religious right will ever say anything nice about keeping religion out of public schools. But, the take home from that is, no, secular humanism clearly is not a religion. You know, whatever religion is about doing, secular humanism is doing something else.
You mentioned philosophy and ethics a minute ago. I wonder if you might go into greater detail how philosophy and ethics may play into secular humanist view, or perhaps are there any tenets of secular humanism?
Well, in terms of philosophy, secular humanism tends toward naturalism. We reject the supernatural. We believe that the world of everyday experience, the world revealed to us by science, pretty much exhaust what exists. The physical world is what there is. There isn't a supernatural realm from which its meaning comes. And in ethics, we tend to be consequentialists. Again, since we're not supernaturalists, we reject command ethics. There's nobody up there in the sky who handed us a list of the best ways to live. We have to find what the best ways to live are for ourselves, as a species, as communities. And the tool we have for doing that is looking at the results, looking at the consequences that come from different courses of action. And so, as secular humanists, we believe that when men and women of goodwill look at the world together and check one another's work in a way that would be very familiar to anyone who understands something about the scientific method, mm-hmm. that's our most likely way to succeed in developing appropriate, pro-flourishing ethical systems.
When did secular humanism first appear, or has it evolved slowly?
It was a Tuesday.
No. Tell us about that Tuesday.
It was kind of cloudy. No, seriously. Secular humanism is kind of a hybridization of two older movements. I think secular humanism comes into being in the middle 20th century. And it represents, as I said, a hybridization or a cross-fertilization, if you will, between the religious humanism that came out of the religious liberal movement and the freethought tradition. Now, to take those one by one, you had two principal streams of religious liberalism that inflected Western culture. One came out of Christianity, and the other came out of Judaism. And there's actually quite a flourishing subculture on the liberal end of both the Christian and Jewish spectrums in Europe and in the U.S. during the 19th and early 20th centuries. By the early years of the 20th century, the Unitarian and Universalist churches had emerged as leaders in the religious liberal tradition on the Christian side. And out of them came the religious humanist movement that sought to create a new religion that had cut all of its historic apron strings with Christianity. And that's where Humanist Manifesto came out in 1933, I believe, which was composed principally by Unitarian clergy. Oh, yes, and John Dewey signed it also. He was the token philosopher on that project. Now, within the Jewish community, you have things like Felix Adler and the Ethical Culture Movement. So, again, on both sides, you had groups that moved towards a humanistic understanding. They still kept a lot of the practices of the church or synagogue congregation, mm-hmm. but they'd abandoned the supernaturalism, they'd abandoned a lot of the authoritarianism. So it was a very liberal religious framework. Now, of course, on the other side of that, you had the free thought movement in the United States and in Europe. The early 20th century, the what's called the golden age of free thought was just drawing to a close. But up through about the 1930s, there was still a lot of residual energy in that movement. And by that point, it was kind of driven underground.
If I may stop you there, why might have been driven underground? What were some concerns?
There was a series of body blows. Basically, the Red Scare following the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, World War I, and that led to dramatic pressures on civil liberties and on dissent generally in the U.S., in England, in Europe. And then finally, the impact of the Great Depression. And so basically what you saw after things like the Palmer Raids in the U.S., the, mm-hmm. The expulsion of anarchists, heavy-duty pursuit of organized communism on American shores, and then just the financial pressures of the Depression. The free thought organizations, which had existed up until that time, all faded out. Basically, by the 1950s, you had just a couple of individuals who were keeping any sort of atheist tradition alive. Joseph Lewis was running the only national atheist organization in the country at that time, and he was a one-man band, and when he died, so did his organization. Emanuel Haldeman Julius was still around, still publishing his little blue books, and But again, he ultimately fell victim to anti-communist agitation. He was the focus of multiple government investigations at the time he mysteriously turned up dead in his swimming pool. So, and by the time we get to the 1950s, the early 1960s, it's a very, very blank stage. Now, one of the things that happened in that period is that a loose coalition of academics, certainly one of the leading figures in this was Paul Kurtz, reached into the religious liberal movement, into religious humanism, into the free thought movement, and consciously tried to create a new life stance movement. There had already been some mentions in the press of something called secular humanism. Mm-hmm. There was a very unfortunate footnote in the Torcaso versus Watkins Supreme Court decision from the early 60s in which Justice Hugo Black erroneously included secular humanism on a list of non-theistic religions. Fortunately, footnotes to Supreme Court decisions do not carry the weight of precedent. But again, that's just been one of those annoying things that our adversaries on the religious right could always drag out and point to. But at any rate, by probably the early 60s, there was something that could be seen as a secular humanist movement just beginning to coalesce. Of course, the other thing that happened in the early 60s in 1963, there was the Supreme Court decision blocking Bible readings in public schools. There were actually two sets of plaintiffs involved in that decision, but one of those sets of plaintiffs, the plaintiff's mother was a woman named Madeline Murray, who eventually married a guy named Richard O'Hare, and as Madeline Murray O'Hare became the face of atheism for several decades. There were good aspects and bad aspects of that, but it has to be said at least that Madeline O'Hare put atheism back on the American stage at a time when most Americans had forgotten atheism even existed and kind of liked it that way.
Is atheism perhaps a necessary but not sufficient condition for humanism, secular humanism? Or essentially, can someone be some variant of religious, identify as religious, or believe in a higher power, a God, yet also identify and relate and be a part of the secular humanist movement?
Well, probably not a part of the secular humanist movement. The humanist movement is diverse. Religious humanism still exists. There's actually quite a growing movement that James Croft and Jennifer Kelmanson and a few other folks and myself have kind of forged a rough and ready agreement to call congregational humanism. And these are basically groups that are, if anything, even more explicit about rejecting supernaturalism, but they still like to preserve trappings of congregational life, getting together for Sunday services, singing in unison, doing social service work, these kinds of things. So there's a good deal of diversity out there, but I think if we're talking about secular humanism, and again, secular humanism explicitly rejects the supernatural. I think a good way to look at atheism is that it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a lot of secular humanists, the process they go through is having been born in the America of decades past, the odds were pretty good that they would grow up in some religious tradition. Eventually, they think their way out of it. Become atheists at first because they've rejected their old religious tradition, they've rejected God, and that was a fair amount of work. And so they stay there for a while and then decide, well, gee, now that I've cleared God out of my mind, where are my values going to come from? And that can occasion a process of moral and ethical and philosophical inquiry that leads people to secular humanism. I mean, that's my own path. I grew up Catholic, and when I finally rejected that in my early 20s, for several years I was an atheist and just an atheist, mm-hmm. and perfectly satisfied with that. And as time went on, I became less satisfied and went looking for, the criteria that I could use in place of the criteria handed down from a God who didn't exist to order my life, and I wound up as a secular humanist.
You had mentioned rituals mm-hmm. a minute ago. What type of rituals typically are formally deemed religious or special, if you will, might a secular humanist movement embrace or incorporate into secular humanism?
Well, secular humanists tend to have a pretty high discomfort level with the rituals borrowed from congregational life. In some cases, this is because these rituals simply remind them of the religious traditions that they've left behind, and they're very happy to have left them behind. Thank you very much. In other cases, I think there's a more nuanced argument that could be made against them too, because there's a subtle authoritarianism in the midst of a lot of these conventional rituals. Look at the marriage ceremony, for example. Mm-hmm. In today's society, it's actually perfectly feasible for two people who feel committed to each other to just live together and live a full life with one another. And some people object to the idea that their relationship somehow needs to be validated by standing up in front of a bunch of other people and getting their approval. I love who I love, and I don't need anybody's approval. And on that basis, a lot of heavy-duty secular people reject that ritual. Some secular people react quite negatively to, for example, unison singing. And I think there's an argument to be made there, because when you really look at the psychology of it, there's some pretty powerful psychological control going on when you take a group of people and have them all shoulder to shoulder and get them singing together. You're really giving whoever's up in that pulpit at the front of the room kind of the keys to your brain, in a way. And a lot of secular people are uncomfortable with that. So I think one of the one of the identifying marks of a secular humanist, if you will, and as a consequence of their being so darned secular, is that there tends to be a lot more discomfort with rituals borrowed from the churches, and not always just because they carry reminders of the discarded religious tradition.
Are there any symbols that are important to secular humanism or humanist movement, such as Christianity may have cross is a symbol, how it functions. Is there anything that might parallel or be an equivalent to a religious symbol, but for the secular humanist?
The council, and in fact a lot of humanist organizations across the world, have settled on a logo. It's called the Happy Human, mm-hmm. and it comes in a couple of different formats. It was actually first developed by the British Humanist Association shortly after the end of World War II. And if you've ever seen the American Humanist Association logo, they're still using it in a classic form. It's a letter H with a little floating round head, and one leg of the H is up higher, a little higher than the other, and it's like the person is going, "Wow, I'm happy." And then in the 70s, one of the Dutch humanist associations updated the logo, did it in more of a brushstroke format, and we licensed that. That's the form of the logo that the Council for Secular Humanism uses. Now, again, because we tend to be individualists and suspicious of unjustified claims to authority, I don't think you'll find too many humanists who are willing to, fall on their metaphorical sword over this logo the mm-hmm. way that some Christians would over the cross. But yeah, it's a logo. I mean, I think it functions for us in the way that any organization or institution's logo functions as a visual identification. But I don't go to sleep thinking of the happy human.
It certainly has meaning. There's no metaphysical dimension or metaphysical meaning to the logo.
Yeah, but you could put it on your T-shirt, and some people will look at that and go, "Oh, there's a humanist."
Is secular humanism growing in America today? Is it in decline? What is the state of secular humanism in America today?
Actually, it's been a fascinating story generally since, say, the 1980s. The number of Americans who tell pollsters that they have no religious identity has more than doubled. It's grown enormously. There's a little more variance in the surveys on this, but it's probably pretty safe to say that explicit atheism and agnosticism have risen about 25% in the same period, perhaps moving from 6% to 8%, to use the numbers from the General Social Survey. Humanist organizations have not experienced quite as much of that growth. What we seem to be seeing is a lot of new people coming out of religion, but not immediately moving into any of the existing life stance organizations. As are all the humanist organizations, we're doing what we can to, beat the drum, keep our name out there, make people aware that this option exists. But right now we're still in this kind of paradoxical period where there's more non-religious people out there than ever. But most of that tide has not shown up at the doorstep of the various national organizations, probably with the exception of American Atheists. They have had explosive growth. They had like 800 people at their last conference in Austin, Texas, for example. Mm-hmm. So it seems that we've got this, if you could talk about this new cohort of the people who show no religious preference. They're just getting to the point where they're willing to be atheists. Now, maybe that means we got a big recruiting opportunity a few years down the pike.
I noticed speaking to them, just being able to be an atheist or be comfortable with that identity, you made an important distinction a minute ago. You talked about explicit atheism. I wonder if you might explain. I would assume there's also an implicit atheism, if you might be able to perhaps talk about the distinction there.
Atheism used to carry a terrible stigma. In some quarters, it still carries some stigma, but it's way more socially respectable than it was. There are an awful lot of places in American life where you can come out now and say you don't believe in God and not worry about your spouse leaving you, your family disowning you, your employer firing you. 30 years ago, those could be real consequences for an awful lot of people. So there's been, I think there's probably always been a phenomenon of closet atheism. People who had worked out the fact that they couldn't believe what the churches were teaching, but they didn't talk about it. They thought it would be, they thought probably rationally that the consequences would be too dangerous if the word got out. So, yeah, you saw an enormous amount of closet atheism, and I'm borrowing the language of the gay rights movement for a very good reason, we think there are an awful lot of parallels between atheism and the various humanisms and where gay and lesbian activists were 30, 40 years ago. One of the things that the LGBT movement did in the 80s and 90s that was enormously important was they really focused on getting the idea out there that gays were far more numerous than commonly believed. They wanted to push the average American into realizing that he or she knew gay people. And, wow, Durfin, he's a nice guy. She's a nice girl.
They exist.
They exist. They're very here. They don't have horns. Hey, they're all right. And that really worked. I mean, the campaign was actually called the We Are Everywhere campaign. What has happened, certainly since the turn of the century, for atheism and humanism is very much the same thing. You know, starting in 2004, we had the string of bestsellers by the Four Horsemen. You know, The End of Faith by Sam Harris, The God Delusion by Dawkins, and so on. And these books have had an enormous impact. In fact, when you talk with a lot of younger atheists, they say reading one of those books was the moment that you know, the scales fell from their eyes. And it was a wild phenomenon. I mean, in the middle 2000s, you could walk into an airport bookstore and find a book about atheism. That had never happened before. And so there has been a, you know, it wasn't brought about in exactly the same way that the LGBT movement did it, but we're in the midst of our own We Are Everywhere campaign, some of it accidental, some of it very deliberate. And we're following the same steps that you know, the gay and lesbian movement followed 20, 30 years ago toward greater social acceptance. And, you know, I think we're moving day by day into a culture where there's less and less stigma attached to coming out of the closet as an atheist or humanist.
If you could leave our listeners with a parting statement or message from speaking to secular humanism or what it is about, what it might become, well, what would that message be?
That message would be, if you're in the closet, come out. If some people know how you see the world, share that with more people. Not, you know, not to be pushy, not to make converts, but just let as many people around you as you can know that they know someone who is an atheist, who is a humanist, who is a secular humanist.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Religious Studies Project.
Just put me on the spot, David, man.
Yeah, right. Okay. Now, you are the non-religion guy, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, secular humanism, are we talking about the same sort of the humanism that we have in the UK? So it's kind of, it's ritual, right?
There's a lot of ritual involved, yeah.
So it's only atheist from a certain point of view, right? It's only atheist from a Tylorian kind of point of view. And from a Durkheimian point of view, it's entirely realistic. It's entirely religious.
If you're going to come in, if you define religion as primarily to do with social groupings and social interactions and
practices ritual, which create a collective social, sense of coherence. Yeah.
Absolutely. If you go down the Tylorian route. Well, on the Tylorian route, one was to say, well, in the idealized, in the ideal type of secular humanism, they don't talk about belief in supernatural or natural. You know, it's just exempt from the discourse. But if you're looking at it in terms of how secular humanism plays out in everyday life, it tends to be involved in a wider societal conversation, political discussion generally about, you know, the sort of legal position of religion, you know, sort of it's involved in a larger conversation like that. But there's maybe nothing in the idealized form that would maybe be related to religion, although would secular humanism mean anything without the religion against which it was articulated.
To relate to my post last week about Bruno Latour. Are we in fact being naive, possibly, about what we ascribe supernatural agency? I mean, what is supernatural? I mean, who draws the line? What's natural, what's not natural? And for a Christian, I don't think Jesus and God are supernatural. They're part of the world, right? Yet Bruno Latour would argue that concepts such as society, culture, that these things are in some way supernatural agents. They're you know, created by humans, but they affect, they exert agency on people. Are we perhaps being naive, or are secular humanists being naive about seeing themselves as not being, not involving supernatural agency, or are we being naive as scholars as making a separation here?
I would say yes. It's probably to both. As we know, in religious studies, you can study a whole variety of phenomena which don't fit the general social classification of being a religion, and discover that, well, you know, when we peel back that sort of obfuscating layer of, well, this is not religious, you discover, well, there's a whole host of reified assumptions, there's a whole unquestioned beliefs, there's, and again, as you're saying there, the idea of the greater good, human flourishing, human progress, that comes up a lot in secular humanism.
And that even relates
to capitalism.
Relates back to Bron Taylor's interview last week as well, talking about, you know, why why do we focus on human flourishing, human communities? Maybe we should be looking at a larger equal sphere.
Yeah. So that therefore we've got this interesting position of religious studies. Well, you're not only looking at things which, you know, it's that fine line of you're looking at things which aren't religious, but well they are in some senses, and I guess the job of the RS scholar is to be constantly uncovering or not uncovering, but making people aware of their assumptions and these sort of, like, well, this clearly isn't religious. Well, really? Is it not? If you look at it from this perspective, it's all about shifting perspectives and being able to take on these sort of thinking outside of your own normative position, our position as scholars. You can look at the whole thing that we do as scholars as being a huge ritual. And so much of sort of critical religion discussion is down to you have to be a feminist and an anti-colonialist, and you have to believe in human rights and all this sort of stuff. But that in itself is an ideology which no one who is in critical religion seems to be very critical of. The idea that you could say that the discourse on human rights is, you know, a social construct.
Yeah.
But again, I think we need to be able to ask those questions. We need to be thinking, why are we so focused on human rights and on the underdog? That is a very modern or postmodern phenomenon. We've whittled on there.
No, it's all good stuff. I think, just to sum up, I think we're both agreed, and maybe the Religious Studies Project in general, is that we're not so here to... We don't see our discipline as... To study religions, but as to study the discourse over what religion, how religion is wielded, you know, how the category is formed.
And some people may find that deeply unsatisfying.
I think so, yeah, but it makes for a much richer field, because we're not only looking at, you know, is Christianity better than Buddhism, or, you know, this is fundamental questions about how human beings construct the categories through which they experience and understand the world, and that's exciting.
Absolutely. So next week,
yeah, let's
get Tim Jensen, or Tim Jensen. He's happy with being pronounced either way, as far as I know. Tim Jensen next week on religious education. I'm really surprised that they haven't touched on this. And for the benefit of listeners maybe outside the UK context, what we're meaning by religious education is religion in mandatory state education. Is that a good way to describe it?
It's a great way. What I'm going to say, Chris, is let's go to the next episode. Let's leave our listeners hanging. You've got to hear this interview. We've got a great interview. We've got a great response. Come back next week. We're going to set the scene.
Thanks for listening.